20-mile-an-hour winds with some gusts up to 40 miles per hour. Right now, wind south at 7. We have some sunshine, 49 degrees for both Kenosha and Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And once again, I am so pleased and honored to say that my morning show guest is the great American composer Ricky Ian Gordon. As we continue the conversation that we began yesterday on the morning show, talking about his remarkable memoir, Seeing Through, a chronicle of sex, drugs, and opera. And in part two of our conversation, we're going to be focusing a bit more on musical matters, and particularly some of the really intriguing things that Ricky Ian Gordon says about his life as a musician and composer, and the way in which he takes us through the creative process, particularly for the many works that he has written for the stage. A process that is rich, complex, sometimes thrilling and exciting, sometimes maddening and frustrating, sometimes ending in triumph, sometimes ending in the ashes of defeat. And Ricky Ian Gordon writes so honestly about all that he has experienced in his eventful and award-winning career. The book, by the way, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and again titled Seeing Through, A Chronicle of Sex, Drugs, and Opera. And Ricky Ian Gordon, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. I'm happy to be here.
One of the things I wanted to be sure to compliment you on is that sometimes when musicians write about themselves and their life and their work as a composer, they forget that there are plenty of people out in the world that are not trained musicians or perhaps not all that well-read in musical matters. And one of the things that I think you do especially well is you talk about your music and your works and your life as a composer in a way that I think just about anybody can embrace and understand. I wonder if that was something you consciously talked about or thought about, or is that maybe the assistance of an editor who helped make sure that you didn't tell these stories in ways that would be laden with musical lingo? How did you manage to achieve this really accessible voice in this memoir?
Well, Greg, there's a really simple answer to that question, which is the memoir is in my voice. I'm not an academic, and I write honestly about that in the book. I'm someone who, from the beginning of my life, loved music, loved poetry, and I ended up doing what I do with my life because I love it and I have figured out how to do it. But, you know, I would be the last person to take apart a piece of music by another composer other than me in any kind of analytical way that would ever be construed as academic. I'm all instinct and all voice. And so nobody had to, you know, Jonathan Galassi, my editor, never said, you know, simplify this. Frankly, he was very, the biggest thing Jonathan said to me was when I handed in an 800-page single-spaced manuscript, he just said, okay, cut it in half.
Oh, so dear.
That was the big thing. And you know, and it was, He really allowed me to construct something on my own, and in that way, it was very much like constructing a piece of music or an opera in terms of going from mood to mood. And, you know, I love the Godard quote, every movie should have a beginning, a middle, and an end, just not necessarily in that order. So it's that sort of, even the construction of the book is my own instinct. Hmm. But no, I only wrote about music as it occurred to me in my heart. Hmm. You know, and as much, Evan, you know, I never thought I'm going to simplify this for unmusical minds. I just had this instinct that if I'm talking about it, it's not going to be off-putting.
Well, I appreciate, for whatever reason, that your book has this voice. And, I mean, I happen to be an educated musician and a professor of music, so, of course, I greedily embraced all of it. But I realize I can hand this book to just about anybody with scant musical background, and they will find so much to enjoy. By the way, this matter of your editor insisting that your original manuscript be cut, that is, talking about this memoir, reminds me of one of my favorite moments in the book, when you are talking about one of your operas and the need to perhaps cut it down a bit. And you write, when before an opera is even completed, someone starts discussing what they think should be cut, it eats into you, eroding the delicate shell you have built to protect your confidence.
Garden of the Fancy Contini's.
Right. So did cutting this memoir feel anything like that? I mean, was this a similarly sort of painful challenge, or did this feel like a very different sort of matter?
It felt different, and I'll tell you why, Greg, because Jonathan Galassi was not saying you have to cut anything because there was anything he didn't like. Every time I sent him something, anything, he'd get back to me like 8 minutes later, and he loved everything I sent him. It was remarkable. We had a remarkable relationship. So I felt loved and protected, and I felt like his basic thing was, you can't put out a book that long. No one will buy it. No one will read it, you know? Especially nonfiction.
Hmm.
So I felt loved and protected. And I just knew what I did was, rather than hacking away at things individually, I just decided to be brave, and I sort of wholesale removed entire sections from the book with a little fantasy that I'll have a book too. And also, one of the things was, we discussed right from the beginning, Jonathan was excited about, I submitted a lot of poems, libretti, lyrics, and Jonathan liked the idea of peppering the book with poems and lyrics, almost like sorbet between courses. And we did, but then it just turned out there just was too much material, so we really removed, I would say, all the poems except for two, I'm pretty sure, are gone. So I just have a lot of material now that I could conceivably use for something else. So I was careful about that, because I just thought, I don't want to just hack away at stuff, because sometimes the sense of something is about how it begins and ends, and you just would rather leave it intact.
Hmm.
I mean, I had a whole huge chapter about foreign film, and I loved that chapter, and it started with this whole meditation on the movie Last Year and Marion Bad, and you know, it's so I'll use that stuff elsewhere. But no, this was not at all like that moment with Garden of Finzi Contini's, which was very upsetting on every level, and especially the way it was presented. I mean, that was, on every level, that was a relationship problem. That was a misunderstanding. That was just a That is an awful story in the world of collaboration. And, you know, that piece had a lot of bumps, a lot of pain, you know, in its creation.
Right. And, of course, that makes it one of the more interesting stories that you tell in your book. And we'll take some of that apart in a moment. Let me just reintroduce you. I'm speaking today on The Morning Show for the second time with Ricky Ian Gordon, the renowned composer, talking about his memoir, Seeing Through, A Chronicle of Sex, Drugs, and Opera. And in this second conversation we're having, we are focusing more specifically on musical matters, including what you say in a chapter in the book called My Process, in which you talk about at least some of the basics of how you go about doing what you do as a composer. One of the things that you say in this chapter is that you like to write first thing in the morning. You say that is when I am as yet unpolluted by my own self-doubt and undistracted by the world. Tell us more about sort of what that looks like when you are sitting down at the crack of dawn to begin the task of writing music. Typically, where are you and what does it look like?
Well, it's usually, even whether I'm upstate or I'm in my apartment in New York City, I get up, the world is quiet, sometimes it's still dark out, I make a big cup of coffee, and then I go and sit down, and usually I look at, I abide by that thing Aaron Copland said about, leave your work when you will be returning it to the next day, excited to return to it. And so I make sure I have something I'm excited about working on and I know what to do. This is unless I'm starting something new, which is a whole other psychotic episode. But if it's just, I just go about it and my voice, my head is quiet and I sort of work excitedly for a few hours. And sometimes Kevin, my partner, will text me and say, do you want to meditate? Then I'll go up and meditate, then I'll have breakfast, and then I'll go back to work again. But there's something about those very quiet early morning hours, and a lot of times they affect the piece. Like Ellen West, my opera, Ellen West, I wrote most of that at like 4 in the morning while I was working on another family opera, The House Without a Christmas Tree in Houston. So it has its own sort of pearly embrace. You know, it's like it really lives in its own iridescent universe. But it's just, it's really, you know, as I've heard said, I wake up in the morning and my demons can be very loud sometimes. So I have to try to, you know, head them off at the pass and get to work before. I mean, we all have our personal crosses to bear, and mine is the voices in my head, and I just try to, you know, face things before they get too loud.
Right.
And a lot of times, and you know, we're in the country, and it really helps me because in New York City, I feel a kind of citywide thrum, like the thrum of ambition, the thrum of movement, of animation. And up here, it's very quiet. I mean, right now, I'm walking around the lake. I don't see a single human being. And it's it helps me because I feel like I'm on my own. I even remember, you know, when I wrote that book, Greg, it was during the quarantine. And I had this feeling every day like no one in the world was doing anything more important than me. We were all just sort of doing whatever we could to fill the time. And I think that's why that book came out so free. I just felt like no one's ever going to read this. We're never even going to get out of this.
So you wrote it for you.
yes.
On the topic of the demons that you try to, in a sense, keep at bay, you also write in this chapter, I always have to make peace with the fact that I hate everything I write at first, but I can't throw it out, because usually as I add to it, I begin to like it. And as it becomes like a tumbleweed growing as it rolls, it becomes the piece. I found that just really interesting because I think a lot of us who have dabbled in composition to one degree or another sometimes are guilty of exactly the opposite and proceed with the mistaken belief that just because this music flowed out of my pen, it must be really special. And it sounds like you are kind of on the other end of the spectrum, where you are in a sense exceedingly harsh with yourself as you first begin the process. How do you make your way through that without just aborting altogether what you have begun to write?
Well, there's another, you know, Jerome Robbins said, do a little every day and it accrues. And the word accrues is very important to me because I just know from experience that as you keep working on something, it's as the notes accrue, whatever you're writing starts to find itself, and it's as if all you needed to do was let it out. And when it just peeks its nose out, you don't know what it is, so you just want to kill it. But as soon as you start seeing the eyes and the lips and the shoulders, it starts to become something. And you really have to trust that if you're an artist, because otherwise, I mean, there are all those cliched movies where you see a writer at a typewriter and they keep ripping paper out of the typewriter and tearing it up and throwing it into the garbage in little balls. I think that's sort of silly. You just don't, you're not going to get the great first sentence if you don't just let something happen. You have to trust in fluency, you know, and fluidity. And so I know that, because otherwise I'd never get anything done. I really wouldn't. I mean, even last night, you know, I woke up at like 3:15 in the morning in such anxiety about whatever I'm working on right now. If I listened to that, forget it. I'd never get anything done. You know, and I, at least finally in the end, I always sort of love what I've written. But, oh, my God, getting there.
We're speaking with Ricky Ian Gordon about his memoir, Seeing Through, A Chronicle of Sex, Drugs, and Opera. Although what you write about in terms of your larger works are operas, you have also been part of the musical theater world as well. And I wanted to ask you about one thing you say about musicals and what is especially challenging about them. You write at one point, musicals are difficult beasts to tackle. Getting the proportions right, the balance between the words and the music, is perilous. That balancing act. Tell us more about what is so very, very difficult about that. It really helps explain why so many musicals are, in a sense, a crapshoot. I mean, even when you have very, very talented people on hand, if things are not mixed or combined or balanced just right, it simply doesn't work.
Well, first of all, let's say you're working on an opera. Just the difference between telling a story that is set to music from beginning to end, then the music has a function that is, it's like the music is the motor. And that is a function unto itself. It's like the train leaves the station, and when it arrives at the end, you have told the story with words and music, and the motor was always running. But with a musical, you have to decide what the function of the songs is, and also how the book tells the story but leaves room for the songs and goes in and out of those songs. And it can be done very inelegantly, and obviously, which is why so many of them fail. And it's just, and it's very collaborative. Like, So you're really in the room all the time with the people that you're doing that with. I mean, I loved working with, when I wrote My Life with Albertine, working with Richard Nelson, because he was very clear from the very beginning when we were adapting Proust about what, how he wanted the music to function and what was going to be the frame for the piece, which was this man, Marcel, was putting on a show in some rich person's living room, telling the story about his life with Albertine. So everything already was theatrical. You had this sort of, he dreamed up a way to create a musical where there was a sort of meta function to it. But it's just, it's very hard. You know, you, and any musical I've written, by the way, Greg, is very, I would definitely say I am of the hybrid variety. I have not written like a commercial musical, and I probably won't, especially at this point. Whatever makes a commercial musical work on Broadway, I would say 99% of the times it's not what I want to do. You know, and it's not to degrade that form in any way, but it doesn't interest me. I never went into it for that. I mean, if you said, like, what drove you into musicals, it was like Mark Blitzstein and John Carlo Minotti and then Stephen Sondheim. But believe me, not a lot of what I grew up hearing as musicals. I didn't want to do that.
As for the operas that you have composed, one thing that I think would be fun for us to explore is when you say, I will always be a set piece composer, being a sucker for arias, duets, trios, ensembles, and choruses. Maybe we should just explain briefly to some of our listeners who might not quite get what you're saying, that there are some operas, and particularly contemporary operas, that are basically like a play set to music. But the more classic form of operas is that something's kind of rolling along, and then suddenly a character sort of steps forward and launches into a wonderful aria, and it begins and it ends. Often there's applause, and you kind of go on to the next thing, and the evening is kind of a series of many such moments like this. And again, many contemporary operas are not like that. They're very through-composed, with not these sort of moments that are arias or duets or whatever. And but your operas are. You like that particular form. Can you tell us more about why? What draws you to want to craft your operas in that way?
Well, first of all, I want to say, when you were describing, in a way, you were describing an old form, like the idea of the star of the opera stepping forward and singing an aria, and the audience applauds, and sometimes they like it so much, and that the tenor, you know, reprises the aria again.
Right.
I would say I'm more of the variety of, I feel like the arias, the duets, the trios, they really serve the plot. They feel very organic to me, as in terms of a part of the story, but they're a place to land, where the heart has a moment to reflect on what's happening in the story with that character or with those characters. And it to me, it's very much about the beauty of music, Greg. Like, my need to make musical theater, which I believe it's all musical theater what I do, even songs are musical theater. They're just little microcosms. But I have to feel like I'm making beauty, even if it's ugly beauty. You know what I mean? Even if the story you're telling is ugly, I have to feel inside of me that it's beautiful. And I rarely, I mean, you know, I talk in my book about the opera Lulu, right? Or Lulu and Wojtek are really good examples. Someone listening to them might think that there's no arias, no trios, but what Baer did that was so smart was he broke those pieces down into small forms. Every scene it might be a theme in variations, it might be a scherzo, it might be a rondo, but it is, even if you don't recognize the form, something in you knows that you're being guided, and that there's a skeleton, at least for me, that is deeply apparent. And so you're not in the wilderness.
Mm.
You're not in complete chaos.
Right. I like that.
Because that's what I can't deal with. If a work is rambling, and if I feel like I'm in a slow, steady state of meandering for an evening, I'm just not, it's really hard for me to stay interested.
Right.
ADD.
I'm very much the same. I feel like when I walk out of a performance, I mean, having just seen an opera, I want to walk out remembering something. I mean, not just the evening as a whole, but I want to whistle a tune or two and think about particular moments. And you're echoing advice to young composers. I remember hearing during a year I spent at the Lyric Opera of Chicago when Dominic Argento came for a visit ahead of a world premiere that was going to occur. And Dominic Argento said, there are not enough young opera composers who think about this, in part because when you write an opera that includes some wonderful arias, those arias can have a life of their own, even apart from the opera itself.
Yeah.
I mean, they can be sung on recitals and concerts and so on, and sort of live on and maybe draw more attention to the opera itself, let alone what you were just talking about in terms of how that, in a sense, can really serve the typical audience member really, really well, instead of just setting them loose in a kind of a swarm of music that, as you said, you know, seems to meander for 2 or 3 hours.
Well, because you said before, sometimes it's just a play set to music. And I have two questions about that. One is, then why are you writing an opera? I write opera because I love opera. I loved opera since I was born. So I want to create opera, and it may be a Ricky Ian Gordon opera, but I want it to be beautiful, like a Puccini opera, like a Verdi opera, on my own terms. You know what I mean? Coming from my own aesthetic. Now, you could say the thing about some operas or plays set to music, and you and I both know, without naming them, that often they're not as good as the play.
Right.
It's like, just do the play. The play is so much better. For one thing, it doesn't take 20 minutes for every line to be spoken because it's sung, and usually it's too slowly paced for what is being said in the play. I do think a lot of people write operas that don't love operas. They write operas because right now it's one of the only ways to make a splash as a composer in the music world. And you can, you know, if you make a splash, it's great. But as Ned Rorem said, when you bomb with an opera, it's an atom bomb. But that's the thing, is I have no desire to just set a play to music. You know, I want to make something of it. You know, I want to feel like I ennobled it, like I took it somewhere the playwright never imagined. You know, it's not incidental music to a play. That doesn't interest me. I'm on my high horse a little bit, but that is something I think about a lot.
Of course. We're speaking with Ricky Ian Gordon about his memoir, Seeing Through, A Chronicle of Sex, Drugs, and Opera, and we are really focusing on the opera of his subtitle and talking about some of his great works for the stage, which he examines in some detail in his wonderful memoir. In fact, we should mention that you made a really conscious choice, although you certainly do talk at many points in your book about the many, many wonderful songs that you have written, that you felt like it was perhaps more important to spend time telling about some of these complicated stories behind your works for the theater. When you talk about one of your most successful and renowned works, the opera The Grapes of Wrath, of course, based on the towering novel of John Steinbeck, you write that, I had to change the way I wrote for The Grapes of Wrath. Explain how you had to, in a sense, transform yourself as a composer, or transform the way you wrote in order to be, in a sense, equal to this challenge and maybe equal to this opportunity.
Well, it was like going from, you know, Dostoevsky writing notes from the underground to, you know, the Brothers Karamazov. It was like, it was, I had only written one opera, and it was Tibetan Book of the Dead, which was, you know, 12 players, 8 singers, and 90 minutes. And now I was faced with a gigantic story. And I knew just from the way Michael Corey and I had spoken about how the libretto would work, I knew I was going to have to hear on a bigger level because of all the simultaneity. I couldn't afford all kinds of, you know, train crashes that were not of my own making, that were not intentional. So I had to learn all the sort of, you know, computer software for writing, and then I had to create all kinds of MIDI files so that I could always hear what I was doing and that other people could hear what I was doing, because I knew I was going to have to do a lot of presenting that opera. And that's where I invented this whole way that I present my work now, which with Great Sobrato, a lot of times I was standing in front of a huge movie screen, and my music would be scrolling by, playing from the MIDI file, which was orchestrated. So a lot of times it sounded pretty good and pretty accurate in terms of what it was going to sound like with orchestra and singers, and I would be on mic singing all the roles. So it really became a whole way for me not to only write, but to present. I mean, I even say in the book, when Peter Gelb from the Metropolitan Opera and Andre Bishop were supposed to hear Act Two of Intimate Apparel, I sort of made them come over to my house, and I seated them on a piano bench in front of my computer, and they heard Act Two scrolling. They heard and watched Act Two scrolling by while I sang all the roles. And Peter wanted me to come to his office, and I knew. I was like, no, I have to control this, or you'll never get it. And so that's what happened. And it really changed my writing enormously in terms of the way I think about, like, especially if you look at a piece of mine like Intimate Apparel, I feel like my style has evolved now, in that the whole notion of a chorus or an ensemble and what are those people doing on the stage has become a very organic, embroidered thing for me. I really loved whatever I did in Intimate Apparel to deal with the ensemble, and now I have a new opera opening with Lynn Nottage and her daughter Ruby, and I deal with it in a very similar way. I really like the texture. It's as if the ensemble become a whole other part of the orchestration.
I want to mention one other thing that you say about your opera, The Grapes of Wrath, and I think one of the things, of course, that has set you apart is or made your work so distinguished is that you really try to bring your whole self to everything you undertake, and that there is nothing generic or rubber stamped about each work. Each one is its own living thing. And you write about this operatic setting of Steinbeck's novel, The Grapes of Wrath. You write, I wanted it to feel like a ballad opera or a musical with set pieces, choruses, arias, duets, trios, and dances that all felt like songs, because the book felt to me so much like the people's novel. Simple enough for anyone to understand and enter, and I didn't want to write something so complex it would alienate the people it was meant for. I just love that idea, and of course, that meant, in a sense, stepping away maybe from who you were or what would naturally resonate with you as an audience member. It caused you, in a sense, to embrace a different kind of voice or a different kind of approach, still very much yours, but in a sense, stepping outside of yourself. And how exciting that must have been.
It was very exciting. And I couldn't have done it without my librettist, Michael Corey, because Michael Corey is, you know, he's a librettist, but he's also a Broadway lyricist that I believe has written some of the best lyrics on Broadway in the last 25 years or whatever. So I felt like whatever he gave me, because we both understood what we were doing and had discussed it right from the beginning. He would give me, like, these lyrics for scenes that their construction was so visible, so apparent. The scaffolding was so transparent that I could look at it and know what to do musically before I even sat down to do it. And that it was really a pleasure in that way. I mean, right from the very, very first, when he first gave me The Last Time There Was Rain, the prologue, you know, when basically in the book, Steinbeck just talks about when the rain ended and the drought began. Michael just wrote something so stunningly simple and beautiful. And I knew everybody was concerned about this urbane, you know, New York Jew, how is he going to find the language for The Grapes of Wrath? And it was just alarming how simple and beautiful and how much he had absorbed Steinbeck and found a way to lyricize it, because the people in the book are not rhapsodic in the way they speak. He had to find a musical language for those voices, but he found it all in Steinbeck. I mean, when Ma Jode has her aria, Us, and she sings, "This dead land is us, all its hardship is us." He found that from one of the women in the camps that they stop in, the Jode stop in along the road. And he willy-nilly took whatever he needed from the prose to turn into lyrics. And I just was astounded. It was, you know, and that's a big thing, Greg, by the way. You know, you don't really talk about it. Yeah, everyone, you know, not you, because you're smart, but everyone thinks opera is a composer's arena. But if you don't have a good librettist, which luckily sometimes is me, but I really feel like I've worked with all the best librettists. That has helped me enormously.
And of course, it's the joy of collaboration. If I may, what you're saying reminds me so potently of my first experience. I have dabbled a bit in composing, and actually at the college where I teach, I've actually crafted a small handful of very modest one-act operas for the opera workshop. And the very first time I did it, it was with a collaborator supplying the words, which was a first for me. And I was so concerned about what would this feel like to be composing music for somebody else's words, or words that I have not chosen, but somebody else has written for me. And I will never forget the first night that these words from the librettist, Matt Barresi, came in, and it was like the music was already there. The music was on the page, and I felt like I was excavating. I was excavating music that already existed, because he, as an experienced librettist, had crafted words that in some way were musical. And of course, you could take five different composers and you would have five different sets of music. It's not that there was one music there embedded in the words, but there was just a musical quality to those words that, in a sense, cried out to be set to music. And you've had that joy again and again in your career. Although once in a while, that collaboration will sometimes be a difficult relationship as well.
Oh yeah, they're not without thorns, those bushes. But the thing is, what you just described, there is the other thing too. When a librettist that you might supposed to be collaborating with hands you something, and you just know, not only will I not be able to set this to music, I can't work with this person. And it's no fault of theirs or no fault of mine, but I hear no music when I look at this. Just like I read millions of poems, but there's, you know, one out of 500 that I think I need to set this to music. It's not a judgment. It's not a judgment of the other poems, but it's the one that sends something, you know, inside me reeling, you know, that I know I have to embrace it that way.
You are you're touching on something else that is so important. Again, this is when you are undertaking various works for the stage, and this is in the chapter where you're talking about the Garden of the Finzi Contentis, which was a very difficult experience for you. you write at one point in talking about the person with whom you were initially collaborating on this, it is, you write about, this is naturally difficult about collaboration. You are completely dependent on your collaborator. And I think a lot of us, when we think about artistic or musical collaboration, we don't necessarily stop to think about that utter dependence that one has on the other and how frightening it must be if one realizes that you are in a collaborative relationship with someone with whom a divorce is maybe impending.
Oh, my God. And the truth is, it's, they don't understand the pace, how important the pace is. They, you know, you're done with the section. You're ready to move on. The music is calling to you. You need the next scene. And they're taking their time or whatever, or that scene is hard for them to write. You want to murder them. It's just like, I need that libretto now. You know, it's very, that is where it gets really hard. And I don't know how to avoid it, but it's, and some people, some librettists don't like that. They just sort of give you everything up front and don't make you wait for stuff, but that's not usual.
At another,
and Michael Corey, who you're talking about, you know, Garden of the Fiends and Continues was a very different thing to dramatize than The Grapes of Wrath, because The Grapes of Wrath, that not only are the act breaks somewhat clear, the structure of the book is clear, but also the events, the beats are very clear. The Garden of the Fiends and Continues is more imagistic. And so it took him longer to find the rhythm and the beats. And it's such a beautiful libretto. I mean, in the end, I so love that opera. And maybe one of the reasons I love it so much is because it was so painful to write. And there were so many bumps in the road. But I really love what we came up with. But wow.
And of course,
still alive.
And of course, one of the things we also learn from your book is also how the collaborative nature of opera is not just a composer and a librettist creating the work, but then all of the collaborations that make it possible for that work to live on the stage. And again, your book is an interesting mix of such projects that went full steam ahead and ended successfully, and others that for one reason or another faltered. You, for instance, tell us about a collaboration you were so excited about with the great Tony Kushner, which ultimately fell apart. At one point you write about the green lights had turned yellow, meaning those for whom you were writing this work, their interest in it, their support for it, began to erode, evaporate, and ultimately vanish altogether. And that, of course, is also sort of a perilous aspect of what it means to be writing musicals and opera in the 21st century.
Yes, and you know, one thing I'm really honest about in that chapter, and you probably remember this, but I also say I liked the idea of collaborating with Tony Kushner. It felt powerful. It felt like it would give me cachet. I don't know how deeply I thought through the idea of writing an opera with him based on the scale of his work. And when I brought an idea to him, he liked the idea. But in the end, he had to come up with an idea that was his, and that's the way he works, and that's absolutely fine. But for where I was in my life, and especially Jeffrey had just died, I was in deep, crippling grief. So I was not ready in any way for someone like Tony, who was going to write a gigantic fantasia that was way more abstract and demanded more of me than I knew I could access. So, but I mean, oh my God, I wouldn't trade all of that chaos and, as Tony would call it, shryerai for anything, because I had this relationship with Tony. We just didn't get an opera out of it.
Right.
But I did get some beautiful arias out of it, like the arias from Angels in America and my aria from Cecilia, The Power of Music.
Mm. I want to mention that your book, of course, includes deep exploration of your relationship with Tony Kushner, with the great Stephen Sondheim, with the great Adam Gettle, and others, and you write so honestly about these friendships and encounters, the joys, the sorrows, the frustrations, all of it is here. I want to finish with a beautiful moment from the chapter you devote to your work called Intimate Apparel, when you write this: "There is so much pain in the world of the arts. You are bolstered and then easily dismissed. You are forever being criticized and compared with others. People, including critics, never look deeply enough into your works to actually see what you were trying to do." I wonder, at this point in your career, when you have enjoyed so much success and renown, to what extent you've managed to come to grips with this part of the life of a professional composer and artist?
I wish I could answer that in a healthy way, but I'm just going to tell you this, that the part of me from whence the art comes is very raw, and it always will be, and whatever my childhood wounds are that make it so that I would like to feel love, but very difficult to feel it, I still really struggle with that. The whole idea of criticism and comparison is always, and probably always will be, painful for me. But, you know, I'm one of those people, I feel like I'll just keep talking about it, and the more light I shed on it, the easier it becomes to sort of saddle it. But it will always be a yoke, you know?
It's just, yeah. Well, I think you say it very well at one point when you say, "I have tried to create a body of work that might be meaningful and beautiful, that might stand the test of time. I work in order to at least try to prove myself equal to all I love and admire." Well, you have, of course, all kinds of fans all around the country and all around the world who so admire so much of what you have created, including this remarkable new memoir, again titled Seeing Through, A Chronicle of Sex, Drugs, and Opera, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, the author Ricky Ian Gordon. Ricky Ian Gordon, thank you so much for being so generous with your time, for being so open in the writing of this book and in the sharing of further stories in our conversations. Thank you so much, and very best wishes with all that you go on to create from here.
Thank you, Greg. All the same to you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you'll be hearing my conversation with William Cope Moyers, one of the country's most important voices when it comes to recovery from addiction. He is well known for his best-known memoir, best-selling memoir, Broken. His most recent memoir is called Broken Open, What Painkillers Taught Me About Life and Recovery. He is coming to southeastern Wisconsin for a book signing this Thursday evening in downtown Kenosha at Blue House Books, and then on Friday serves as a keynote speaker for the 15th annual Help and Hope Conference on Substance Use Disorders. Join me for tomorrow's conversation with William Cope Moyers. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, and you can find The Morning Show podcast by looking for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Partly sunny skies today and mild conditions with a high of 66 degrees, but some clouds tonight with a 40% chance of rain and a low of 58. Sunshine should return tomorrow. We warm up to a high of 80. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. WP